Canon Press Audio presents the 2006 ACCS Conference, copyright 2006. If you would like to find out more about related audio sets and books, you may call Canon Press at 800-488-2034. For a complete listing of our products or to order online, please visit our website at www.canonpress.org. Thank you for purchasing this audio set.
Good morning. Let's go ahead and get started. My name is Rob Williams, and I teach at Regent School of Austin. I currently teach 8th grade New Testament and 20th century history, but I did my time. I spent 8 years teaching 6th grade. Before that, I did a little administration as headmaster, and before that, I taught 4th and 5th grade, and I love grammar school. And I miss it dearly. I enjoy teaching 8th graders. They're a bit more analytical, and they challenge me on a regular basis, but I love it. But I miss grammar school as well. There are certain natural laws or principles that govern the operation of the universe. Even those who don't believe in an omniscient deity will usually attest to the existence of these laws or principles. They're obvious to the observant mind. For example, the farmer will follow certain laws or principles of sowing and reaping. Any plant requires an abundance of sunlight. Without sunlight, photosynthesis cannot occur, and without photosynthesis, no glucose can be produced, and without glucose, the plant has no material from which to grow or has no energy to use in that growth process. Thus, the farmer who desires vibrant plant growth will sow his seeds during the spring months, when the hemisphere that he is living in is tilted, oriented toward the sun. He would be a fool who would plant the same crop in late fall. For just when the sprouts began their ascent, the intensity and duration of sunlight would be diminishing, adversely affecting the quality of his crop. Now, the farmer would still be engaged in the process of cultivation, yet his results would be disastrous for the plant simply because he did not follow some fundamental, and to the majority of cognizant people, elementary principles of productive crop cultivation. Likewise, there are key principles or laws when one is cultivating the mind that, when followed, are likely to produce very positive results. These principles are effective such that, when adhered to, the result is a healthy learning environment. When disregarded, the learning process can be greatly impaired. Now, we as teachers, I do believe that we desire to be highly effective with the art of instruction. As such, we would be wise to learn, study, review, and apply these principles of teaching. Now, Gregory has delineated and expounded upon these laws of learning in his book, The Seven Laws of Learning, which I assume that most of you in here have read. And if you have not, I charge you to read the book prior to re-entering the classroom in the fall. This is one of the books that it's a good idea to go back and read every single summer. This morning, my aim is not simply to discourse about the general principles of Gregory's laws, which, as I have already alluded to, have great inherent value, but rather to apply these pedagogical principles to the subject of grammar school mathematics. But you can apply it to any subject matter. And hopefully, by thinking about math instruction in light of the seven laws of learning, we will become more effective math teachers, more effective grammar teachers, or more effective School of Logic teachers, who purposefully create a classroom atmosphere which overtly and subtly induces comprehension and curiosity about math. Now, Gregory begins his book with a wonderful definition of teaching. Teaching is simply painting in the mind of another the picture in one's own mind. I like that. Some contemporary teachers, however, are like abstract postmodern painters, kind of like Jackson Pollock instructors, hurling buckets of knowledge onto the canvas of the mind, assuming that the student will, in some form, in some time in the future, organize all the pieces of information, put them together, and they'll achieve some level of understanding. Okay, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and it'll all blur together, and they'll have some form of understanding. But good classical education is not haphazard. Education is not attained by mishap and accident. Rather, a well-trained mind is acquired by years of being under the tutelage of teachers who are instructing with intent, guided by principle toward objective goals. The seven laws of learning are some of the most poignant and helpful principles to aid you in the art of instruction. And as an aside, I'd like to expand for a moment on the idea that teaching is an artistic craft. And an artistic craft is an inherent, innate skill that not everyone has and very few master. And just like great visual or musical artists, teaching becomes skilled. A teacher becomes skilled in the craft over time, creating exquisite works on living canvases. Too often, though, teachers give up after a year or two of teaching. They might say to themselves, well, I had a really bad year, or maybe I don't have the gift, or I will segue and try another profession. Or they look at another teacher, an accomplished teacher that maybe they've been in the classroom for 15, 20, 25 years, and, you know, well, I don't stack up against them very well, therefore I must not have the gift, and they give up and they forget that it is an art. It's not merely just a job. In relating to children, taking material, assimilating it yourself, coming up with creative ways in which to engage the minds, that is an art. And my lifelong goal is to be a master teacher when I'm maybe 80, 85. Every year I look back and I engage in a self-assessment. I mean, everybody remembers their first year of teaching. You look back and went, what did I do to those children? My word, did they learn anything? Will they ever recover? Second year, my word, what did I do to those children? Third year, my word. And it gets progressively better and better. And every year I go back and I look over my lesson plans, I look at my notes, and I constantly find myself editing, going, oh, I thought that was good at the time. It's kind of deplorable. And my wife, I've been teaching for close to 15 years now, and she'll sometimes I still come home late, and she says, well, what are you doing? You taught sixth grade for 8 years. What in the world could you be doing at that school? Well, I don't want to teach the same thing in exactly the same manner because I get bored. And it has to stay fresh, there has to be a passion, and so I'm improving. It's the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth edition of my teaching. It's an artistic craft that is being honed. So if you have recently completed your first year of teaching, and you've taken an assessment of yourself, and you're a bit discouraged, be encouraged. Okay, don't give up. Stay in it for the long haul. Okay, when you reach age of 65, 70, or 75, you and I might actually be able to teach very effectively. That's the hope. The kids are getting a great deal out of it, even first-year teachers, believe me. Now, great teachers may not consciously be aware of these laws of learning, but I'm sure that most of them naturally employ these laws. It's similar to a gifted musician that can play by ear, that has no formal musical training. They just know when something is on or off key. And a natural teacher they have this inherent sense of how to teach, how to communicate with a child, how to deal with a parent. Law number one, a teacher must be one who knows the lesson, truth, or art to be taught. Now, you need not have complete knowledge of a subject you are teaching, but you need to thoroughly understand the lesson that you are presenting. In math, don't do this. And I say that because I have done this numerous times. Do not read over the lesson 5 minutes before you get up to teach. Or say to yourself, oh yeah, I remember that lesson from last year. Read over the lesson. Work out the example problems yourself. Work out the problems on the board. I've been caught more than one time teaching a lesson before an empty classroom. And yes, my peers have crossed the threshold of my room and interrupted me with bedazzled looks till I explain to them that it's not an imbalance of my medication, it's a refinement of my art is what I'm doing. Remember, teaching is an art, and your performance should be so well done that it results in understanding and it piques the curiosity of students for more. And how many performances are successful without a rehearsal? One of the best ways to prepare for a math lesson is to work the entire lesson by yourself the day before so that you can understand the lesson from the student's perspective. If for example, if you struggle with number 15, how much more will they? And rather than trying to figure out how to work out and explain in the best manner number 15 in an impromptu fashion, which has the possibility of reducing the student's respect and confidence in you, especially if you dither for too long a period of time trying to figure it out. Wouldn't it be more effective to tell the kids that number 15 is a bit tricky and be able to give them some hints on how to solve it? It is a good idea to work the entire lesson by yourself and do it in a student desk. I do that quite often, and it's also very effective to videotape yourself sometimes teaching and then watch yourself and see how quickly you begin to doodle. Okay? If you get bored watching yourself, how much more will your students? You want to be able to effectively and quickly help a child that is struggling maybe with a particular concept. And you get to number 15, and if you haven't thought about, well, let me think of another way to approach this problem. If you haven't thought that beforehand, you're wasting time. Like I say, you're dithering. I just love that word, dither. Great English word, don't dither. About 3 weeks ago, I was in HEB. It's a grocery store that we have in Austin, and a woman from England walked up to me and she said, excuse me, do you know where the trolleys are? What the trolleys? San Francisco. So no, you know those containers that you put your produce in, you want out? Grocery carts, trolleys, I love that. It's fantastic. So next time you're in the grocery store, ask, manager of the store, where are the trolleys? If you don't understand the lesson yourself or only have partial comprehension, then you can't expect the students to do well. That's why it's so extremely beneficial to learn the concept thoroughly. Think through it and slowly digest it. By the way, that's the catalyst for creativity. It is of the utmost importance that you, as a teacher, understand and can communicate the lesson or truth to someone else in your own words before you teach it. You need to internalize the lesson. If you don't, there is a very high probability that your lesson will be unsuccessful or dull. Now, I am not advocating that all lessons be entertaining, but I am of the opinion that a lesson need not be uninteresting because we have, as teachers, failed to put forth the effort to make it intriguing. For example, let's suppose I'm introducing basic algebraic equations in which the students will be asked to solve for a single variable. How am I to proceed? What should I not assume that my students already know? I know I must first explain to my students what an equation is. I'll write the word on the board and maybe stare at it for a while. Sit in their desk and look at it, pondering definition of that word. Perhaps I'll even wait with the students ask the students from a student desk, what does it mean, an equation? Invariably, a student will say it means something to the effect of two things that are equal, quantities that are equal. At that point, I will concur with him or her and bestow great praise upon them. Then I'll proceed by asking for an example, possibly by talking about a balance used to weigh goods in the ancient world. I might just assemble a first-class lever with a board and a cinder block and attempt to balance students of approximately the same weight. And at this point, I might place a petite young lady and a husky athletic boy on the scale in order to drive home the idea of an inequality. Then I might proceed by writing a simple equation on the board and asking why it is an equation, something very advanced, 2 + 2 = 4. They would obviously answer because both sides equal 4. And I would ask, well, what symbol is being used to denote equality? Students will probably answer in very short order, well, the equal sign. I will reply with another question, why such a symbol? What can be deduced about the symbol by careful study? Why do we use two parallel lines of the same length to communicate equality? Then I might ask them, why not circles, squares? Eventually, they will answer because of the simplicity and ease of writing the symbol. Then I might proceed by adding another 2 to the left side of the equation, then asking them, what is now wrong with the equation? It is no longer true because it fails to validate reality or what we know by experience to be true. 2 + 2 = 6. So I asked my class, can we infer, which means to draw a conclusion based on this equation, I would tell my kids, that a math problem is true when it conforms to reality, explaining to them that 2 apples and 4 apples = 6 apples and not 4. And problems that fail to conform to reality or that which is are false. Once we are all in agreement, I might ask them what such equations tell us about the universe. If 2 + 2 + 2 = 6 and never 4, then what? And if true mathematical equations are those that are congruous or conform to reality, truth, or that which is, might it also be reasonable to deduce that there are other truths about this world we inhabit? Could there be truths about how to live our lives? What might be an equation, students, for a good life be? Love God, obey Him, equals peace. What might a false equation be? What would you think of somebody, students, living according to this mathematical equation? 8 × 20 = 3. I might have the class imagine an individual who is living according to this false equation, working for Federal Express as a courier, being paid $20 an hour, working 80 hours delivering packages a week prior to Christmas. And this individual earns his pay. Now, if he believes the false equation that 80 × 100 = 3, what sort of ramifications might he incur? Well, let's suppose that he is responsible to turn in his own hours. Obviously, he miscalculates his hours worked, and rather than receive the proper payment for the hours worked, $20 an hour, 80 hours a week, $1,600, he receives instead $60. Now, what would you think of an individual who lived according to such a false mathematical equation? But students, isn't it amazing and disconcerting that people who live according to, that there are people that live according to such ludicrous equations of life? Gossip and slander will equal friends. Apathy and complacency will lead to happiness. Now, they may not consciously articulate that, but many times they live according to those false equations. when students understand what an equation is, I might go back to the balance and put on each side two students of approximately the same weight. Then I would ask the students, what would happen if I climbed on the shoulders of one of the students? Is the equation now true? How could I keep it true if I remain on the shoulders of one of the students? Thus, we get into the idea of balancing an equation. And it's at this point that I can explain how to solve for a single variable. And all of this would look natural, like it was off the cuff. But it's not. Now, obviously, I'm not going to be able to teach all my lessons like this, but as I continue to learn and grow as a teacher, more and more lessons will become more and more engaging for the students. And that's why it's such a good idea to stay at a certain grade level for a number of years. You become more proficient, your lessons become more interesting, you internalize the information more so that you can interact more freely with the kids. You can feel the freedom, the liberation to leave the safety of the podium where your outline is. Teaching is an art perfected over a substantial period of time. This brings up a point. Teachers are always learning. They are always students. They are humble in regards to their knowledge because the more they learn, the more they realize that they don't know. It's okay to read 5 books or more simultaneously. It's okay. I get critiqued all the time by my wife by having numerous books open on the bedside table. She says, you start so many books and you never finish half of them. I'm like, well, I'm sorry. But I'm curious, okay? And I clean up after myself. Teachers that are always learning exude excitement about learning because they can't keep it to themselves. They're not forced to teach by some external mean, but rather are compelled by an intrinsic passion. And our knowledge also helps children have confidence and trust in us. Children will not follow one they have no confidence in. Well, so-and-so really doesn't know what they're talking about. Okay, they're not going to be very attentive. It's okay to say, I don't know, when a very astute student will sometimes hurl a very thought-provoking question, maybe that you haven't considered before, but that should not be your everyday response. I don't know, I haven't thought about that, I don't know. Get back down that one, okay? Or how about this one? This is always the easy way out. You know what? That's a great question. Why don't you come back tomorrow with the answer? Do a little research, okay? Figure it out on your own. Yeah, I know it already, but you know, I want you to know it. Some tips from the book. Prepare each lesson by fresh study. Study the lesson until you understand it well and can communicate it in language students can understand. Don't use terms that you have not defined numerous times. If you have to define for them variable, parallelogram, okay, 20, 25 times, okay, that's okay. Don't assume that they understand that term after you've only used it 2 times. Think of illustrations and examples. That's why it's such a good idea to go through the teaching process, to go through your lesson, have a mock run-through the day prior. Oh, this would be a great example right here. Oh, that would be an excellent illustration. Huh, how am I going to communicate that? That's kind of an abstract concept for a 12-year-old. All right, let me think of some examples from life. All right, let me sit down in their desk and get uncomfortable on this wooden or plastic chair. All right, and my mind's wandering. Okay, so how's my teacher going to bring it back in? What would be an effective way? Blah, 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 blah. It'll make all the difference in the world, I promise. Law number 2, a learner is one who attends with interest to the lesson. Now Gregory describes 3 types of attention. There's passive attention, no effort of the will, and this type of attention will follow the strongest stimulus. TV is a great example, passive attention. What are you watching? I don't know. How long have you been watching it? I don't know. What are the main points? I don't know. Then there's active attention. Effort of the will is needed. Active attention, you concentrate and attend to something, disregarding other attractive stimuli. And then there's absorbed attention. And this is our goal. Fascinated and absorbed by the subject matter. Now, quite often, active attention can lead to absorbed attention. We've all experienced this reading a great work of literature. It can be maybe a difficult work that's hard to get into, but by the time you're in the second or third chapter, you're hooked. Your active attention has become absorbed attention. You picked up the book because somebody in the classical education movement said that as a teacher you should have read this. And so you pick it up and you begin to read, and lo and behold, you do find that it has some inherent value. And before long, you can't put it down. Active to absorbed. So how do we as teachers encourage absorbed attention during math? How do we get the students thinking? We get them thinking by getting them involved. For example, let us suppose that I am teaching probability. I am going to introduce the whole concept of probability. Now, the insipid, boring way to do it would be simply to explain what probability is according to the definition provided in the book, and then illustrate this concept by working the practice problems. Probability is a ratio. Possible outcomes on the bottom, favorable outcomes on the top. We've all flipped a coin before, okay? Watch me flip a coin, okay? And let's record the data after 10 flips. This will elicit very short attention spans for the students and entrench the false notion that math is dry and unappealing, which it is not. However, if I spent time thinking about the lesson and possibly looking at other math books for ideas, maybe higher level math books about how to teach the concept of probability, I might come across a very, very good illustration. Now, when I taught probability, I taught probability by games. To begin with, I would show students how to play a dice game. I would explain that throughout history, countless numbers of people have tried to acquire wealth by unscrupulous means, such as the dice game of craps. Ill-gotten treasure is of no value. That would be my scripture reference for the day. Now, I've got their attention not because of the scripture reference, but probably because I use the word crap. Now, the basic rules, you have a pair of dice. The basic rules are you roll a 7 or an 11 and you win. You roll a 2, 3, or 12 and you are out and lose your money. Now, at this point when you explain the games, most assuredly the kids will say, well, can we really play, okay? No. Meet me after school around the back of the gym at 3:30. Now, I asked the kids, I would draw an illustration on the board of die 1 and die 2 and illustrate to them all the possible combinations. We have 36. Now, kids, probability is the possible outcomes. What are all the possible outcomes? 36. Fantastic. Now, let us consider how many different ways we can get a 2. Okay, well, there's one way. How many ways can we get a 3? How many ways can we get a 12? Okay, well, how many ways can we lose? And before long, we realize that the probability of winning is 8 to 36, or 22%. The probability of losing is 4 to 36, 11%. Now the kids really want to play because there's a higher probability of winning and increasing their net value than losing. Now, at this point, we might talk about how one might use unscrupulous means to increase his or her probability. How could you reduce the probability of losing and increase the probability of winning? For the love of money is the root of all evil, kids. And probably won't be long before they figure out, hey, trick dice, loaded dice. That's right, kids. Let's look at some loaded dice. Okay? There we have. And the kids can see the different combinations. Now remember, in order to lose the game, you have to roll a 7 or an 11. Or if you realize, I'm sorry, you have to roll a 2, 3, or 12 to lose. And if you realize, based on the two dice I have up here, the loaded dice, there is no way that you can lose. Okay? Now, people that you typically would engage in the game of craps with would be a little bit upset if they found out that you were using loaded dice and you could end up with a sharp implement in your gut. And that's why you don't want to engage in the game of craps. Moral lesson for the day. But they have stayed engaged the entire time with my lesson on probability, and I would have some dice as well. We would probably play a few rounds, maybe with some fake money. Okay, make up some paper money with denominations of, you know, 1, 5, and 10, and then they come home, and then parent says, so what did you do in math today? A little gambling. Shot a little craps. Yeah. Wow, what are you doing tomorrow? I don't know, Mr. Williams is going to give us a pack of lucky strikes. No. Now, this wouldn't come about if I hadn't thought about the lesson. And I actually found this illustration in another math book, and it was actually a college math book explaining basic mathematical concepts to non-math majors. And great illustrations in that book. But it took, you know, some serious, you know, research and reading and studying, looking for a better way to communicate a concept that the kids initially might not have found that intriguing. So some practical tips for encouraging absorbed attention. Never begin without attention of the class. Stop when you lose attention of the class. And I always tell the kids when I'm behind, when I step up behind my podium or my music stand, focus on me. And if you hear me stop talking and I'm behind the music stand, okay, that is your cue to focus your attention back on me. And invariably, it always happens. I'll step back there and there'll be one student that's having an animated conversation for 15 minutes. I'm just watching. And everybody else is, shh. Mr. Williams, back there. And then I give them the long, dumbfounded stare. Whenever you're ready. Stop when you lose the attention of the class. Use examples from their life. Move. I would be moving around a lot right now, but I'm kind of anchored to the podium and this microphone right here. Bunny trail when appropriate. Think of questions they might ask beforehand. Like I said, sit in a student desk and listen to one of your lessons. Think about ways that you could enhance it. If you provide an illustration for the kids, you're watching yourself on videotape, and you don't quite get your own illustration, might want to change it. Remember, the goal is not to get through the curriculum. The goal is to teach them how to think and learn for themselves. Law number 3, the language of the teacher and the student must be common to both. Students can only understand concepts related to them in their own vocabulary. It's imperative that students acquire the language of math, but don't expect them to acquire the language without the constant defining of terms from the teacher. Define new terms multiple times. Variable, prime numbers, factors, congruent triangles. As time progresses, use the terms with increasing frequency without defining them. And this brings up the importance of enhancing the vocabulary of students. Use words that are above their vocabulary level, but be sure to define the words. I'm always conscious of enhancing the breadth of my students' vocabulary, for words are the manifest symbols that give life to their thoughts and opinions. And the student that is limited in his or her use of words is stymied in the expression of his or her thoughts. How many times do you ask an open-ended question to a student and they say, well, you know what I mean, don't you? No, I don't. You need to put words to your thought. And as teachers, we are constantly modeling, not for the purpose of trying to impress the students, but to give them an idea of how a particular vocabulary word is properly used in context. Very often, we'll give them a list of vocabulary words, they memorize those, and they regurgitate them on a spelling vocabulary test, and perhaps they have to put them in a sentence, or they figure out which word should go in an appropriate sentence that has a blank. But very often, we forget to actually use the words and illustrate them multiple times. How many times do you have to hear a word used correctly in context before you fully understand the definition of the word? I don't know, 15, 20, 25 times, maybe? And you can have word lists that you want, words that you want the kids to acquire. You can make a little list, put on your music stand. I'm like, man, I'm going to make sure to use that word 5 or 10 times today. Context. Because I want the kids to understand it. I want that word to reappear the next time they turn in an essay or something for me. We're always modeling, always raising the standard for them. For example, I might say, Peter at first could be described as audacious. Well, kids, that's just bold and impetuous, which means he rushes into things without considering the consequences of his actions. Now, I know that none of you have ever done that before. But toward the end of his life, the words sagacious and prudent, which both mean showing good judgment and wise, more accurately described his character. Okay. Now, it wouldn't be that artificial. But. Lesson number 4, truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. Knowledge builds upon knowledge. I believe grammar school teachers do a great job introducing new concepts based on previously learned knowledge. But in my experience, they don't teach new truths in light of future truths which will follow. And what I mean by that is just teaching the 3rd, 4th, or 5th grade concepts and not cognizant of the purpose for which these concepts are being learned. What is the goal of learning polygons? Your 4th grader asks. When will I ever need this? Well, it lays the foundation for being in a position to learn the postulates and theorems of geometry. Why do I need that? Well, this will lay the foundation for solving geometric proofs. Why do I need that? Because that will train you in logical reasoning. Why do I need that? Well, let's go into a discussion about what it means to be a citizen in a democracy that participates in government, and how can you not be duped by a demagogue or somebody that will say anything to get into office, okay? That's why you're learning polygons, so you can learn geometry, so you can learn logic, so you can learn truth. That's why. And your 4th grader will say, oh. Maybe I won't challenge you next time. Here's an example. A student is learning about angle relationships, and they ask why they are learning it. I would answer, you're going to be faced with problems in geometry in which you will need to utilize all the information you are learning now about geometry so that you can prove mathematical truths, and these are called proofs. And by working proofs, you will be enhancing your reasoning abilities, which you will need in order to be an insightful, prudent, contributing member of society who won't be duped or taken advantage of by unscrupulous people. For example, you guys are so stinking brilliant. I bet you can figure out how to prove the following statement. Here's the statement. The sum of the measures of the angles of any triangle, interior angles of any triangle, is 180 degrees. Now, guys, I bet you can prove that. You astound me every single day. You're brilliant. My word. Encourage them like that. They're like, you bet I am. That's right. Bring it on. What's the statement? I can prove anything now. Well, I'd give them a little bit of information. I'd review alternate interior angles. I tell the kids, okay, we've talked about this in lesson 65. Whenever you have two parallel lines and you have a line intersecting both of these called a transversal, you have special angles created. You have a special angle relationship between many of these angles. This angle and this angle are equal right here. This angle and this angle are equal as well. Congruent angles, corresponding angles, alternate interior angles. Say, okay, kids, so we remember, we'll call this angle A, and we'll call this angle B, and you can just see by the way it's drawn that those are equal angles, correct? Yes, Mr. Williams, fantastic. I told you that you were brilliant. Now, if two lines are parallel, then the alternate angles, like I said, are congruent. Congruent, that's a great word that you probably need to know. What does it mean? It means two lines, two polygons are exactly the same size. They have the same dimensions. Figures that have the same size and shape, we call them congruent. What do we call them? Congruent. What does congruent mean? Fantastic. And guys, you probably heard a minute ago, I called this intersecting line a transversal just because it intersects these two parallel lines. What is it called? Transversal? Fantastic. What does trans mean, by the way? That's right. Trans, go across, transportation. Why do we call that? Blah, 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 bunny trail. Now we're back. Now kids, you know that A and B are equal. What I'm gonna do right now is I am going to draw a triangle inside my parallel lines. And guys, check this out. Here are my parallel lines. I'm going to draw a triangle right here. Now, I have told you that three interior angles of any triangle always equal to the sum of 180 degrees, and we're going to prove this, but you guys are going to prove it. You're going to figure it out, because haven't I already told you that you're brilliant? Guys, what shape is that? And they're like, looks like a half a circle to me. That's right, fantastic. And how many degrees are there in a half circle? Okay, remember, 360, one full rotation on your skateboard, half of that would be 180. That's right, okay. And 180 degrees, that is called what kind of angle? Supplementary. Oh, that's right, supplementary angle, fantastic, or a straight angle. Okay, now, we know, we'll call this angle 1, this angle 2, and this angle 3 right here. And the sum of these three angles is what? 180 degrees. Fantastic. Now, all I want you to do right now, I want you to imagine that this line, this leg of the triangle right here, is not here. We just have this. Oh, what's that word? It's escaping me right now. I cannot remember. Transylvania, yeah, transversal. That's right. Wonderful. Now, do you remember what I said about a transversal? Oh, something about the interior angles. That's right. If we just look at that transversal, this angle right here is equal to this angle. So that's a one. Oh, well, imagine that this leg of the triangle is not there. And this transversal, this angle is equal to this angle, so this would be a 3. 1, 2, 3 equals 180. 1, 2, 3 equals 180. You have just proved that geometric postulate. All three angles of any interior triangle, any interior angles add up to a sum of 180. Guys, that is amazing how you figured that out. Wasn't that fun? You want to do another one tomorrow? Okay, and they will. And you show them where they are going. Why are we learning about angles, intersecting lines, congruency? Why are we learning that, Mr. Williams? This is why. And then from that, that reflects a truth that can never be changed. That is an absolute. And if we have an absolute in mathematics, isn't it probable that there is absolutes about every aspect of our lives?
Yes.
That's right. Wow. And if there's absolutes, there must be an absolute giver. There's got to be a God. And that's another bunny trail you can get on. You may never come back from that one. Get very lost. What have I just accomplished? I've validated what we are learning and instilled confidence and hopefully stoked the flames of passion a little bit more for mathematics. Now, by being able to do this requires that we as teachers know more than what is merely stated in our textbook. And I think sometimes we're guilty, especially when we get into the hustle and bustle of the year, to read lesson number 16 and say, yeah, I get that, I kind of understand. Okay. Why are they learning that? I really don't know. So when a student asks me that, I'm going to say, because you're going to need it someday. Why will I need it? Being able to do this requires that, like I said, we might have to read math books, review the concepts a year ahead of the grade that we teach, or 2 years, or 3 years, and that's okay. This will take time, but remember what I said at the beginning of my presentation. Teaching is an art, it's a craft that is developed over time. Don't be dismayed. When I come to conferences, remember when I first started coming to conferences, I would hear people share some of their classroom experiences, their lessons, and say, oh gosh, boy, did I botch that up. Why didn't I do something like that? I'm a failure, I'm terrible. The world still needs welders. Perhaps I'll consider that. Law number 5, teaching should arouse and use the student's mind to grasp the idea or truth. Make your student, when at all possible, a discoverer of truth. Don't teach him what he can learn on his own. We learn best when we make discoveries with our own mind. Now, we as teachers know this. When we have to teach a subject, we learn it like we have never learned it before, right? Oh, I really understand that for the first time. If you just tell students everything that they need to know and you don't let them lift up the rock and discover the nugget of knowledge underneath it on their own, they are much more likely not to remember it. And they are much more likely to not enjoy the learning experience. Kids are naturally curious. Let them be. Don't answer everything for them. Let them discover. Remember, we want to always encourage self-learning. We want them to leave school with the tools of self-education. And we can't accomplish this if we chew and digest every nugget of knowledge for them. As an example, another geometry problem. I would draw this triangle on the board and I would pass out protractors and have the kids measure all of the angles and then I would tell them this, or I might write it on the board. The measure of an exterior angle, the 120, if you can see that in the back, is equal to the measures of the two non-adjacent interior angles. Say, guys, this is a mathematical truth. This exterior angle, this 120, is equal to the sum of these two non-adjacent. Now, what does adjacent mean? Oh, right next to each other. So non-adjacent, not adjacent, not next right to each, not right next to each other, would be these angles. Oh, okay, that makes sense, Mr. Williams. What does adjacent mean? That's right. What does transversal mean? That's right. What does congruent mean? Good, fantastic. Okay, remind me, because I'm getting a little bit old and, you know, I have these lapses of memory. Now, I could have just told the kids that. Or, what would be better, I would have them measure the three interior angles and the exterior angle and then just sit down and say, do you notice anything interesting about that exterior angle, 120, and any of the other angles inside the triangle? I will be at my desk. When you have an interesting observation or insight, tell me to come back up to the podium and just let them figure it out. It's not long before, you know, okay, that doesn't end up. Hey, look at that right there. 70 and 50, that's 120, that's 120. And I might draw maybe five or six other triangles. And it's not long before they're like, wait a minute, Mr. Williams, that exterior angle right there, that equals the sum of those other two angles on the other side. That's right, fantastic. You have figured out another truth. Yesterday, you proved a truth to me, you figured out another truth. You're a seeker of truth. Did you know that? You're a lover of knowledge. You're a philosopher. You thoroughly impressed me. I am wowed and bedazzled by you. This is amazing. You're a seeker of truth, you're a philosopher, and you know how to play the game of craps. That classical education right there. It's okay for there to be a lengthy pause as well. You sit down for 5-10 minutes, let the kids consider it. Now when they get to, you know, start chatting with one another on topics other than geometry, you know, bring it into that, but let them ponder, let them figure it out, they will. And they will just beam, they'll just become illuminated when they do. They'll feel so good about themselves, come home, Mom, I love math. I really do. Really? Well, last year, you know, you said you didn't like math, kind of dry and boring. No, I love math. And I think I'm good at it. That's what we want. Law number 6. The student must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be learned. Student has not learned until they can express the lesson in their own words. When they can communicate it in their own words, the truth or lesson has become their own. Law number 7. The test of teaching done must be reviewing, rethinking, reknowing, reproducing, and applying of the material that has been taught. Let me say that again. The test of teaching done must be reviewing, rethinking, reknowing, reproducing, and applying of the material that has been taught. Be very wary of assuming that your students understand a concept, whether it be math, science, history, Bible. Even if you've gone over it 2 times and it seems to be quite simplistic, watch out. Check for understanding. Do you understand this? Yes. Prove it to me. Would you come up to the board and prove to me that that exterior angle has a relationship between the two other non-adjacent angles? Would you do that for me? Bring up your protractor, okay? Show me, please. Because a lot of times they will just give you an affirmative just to move on. And you cannot move on until a concept, until they understand a concept. If you do, you're going to be building upon a faulty foundation. There's going to be gaps, there's going to be cracks. And they'll get up to 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th grade. Like, yeah, I really never got that concept back then. One third of every lesson should be review, according to Gregory. And review concepts and truths taught throughout the day. This is one of the things I miss about grammar school, is that you teach a myriad of subjects and there's always crossover, and just because you're done with math, it doesn't mean that the subject of math is closed. And it can come up during literature. It can come up during writing. Hey, wait a minute. This isn't math. And this is not a democracy. It's a tyranny. and math is still with us, okay? And it's not going anywhere. Constantly reviewing, and that's the thing that I really loved about teaching in grammar school. All throughout the day, I could revisit concepts that maybe I talked about in the morning, the day before, a week before. Numerous passes cement concepts, but they also deepen our understanding. We know that by reading great books. With each reading, the book becomes richer and more lovely. A time lapse can change our perspective greatly. Mountain climber, for example, his view changes as he ascends higher and higher and higher up the mountain. A fresh topic or lesson never reveals all of itself at first. And you need to tell your kids that don't ever assume that you know something thoroughly to the extent that you cannot be taught something new about that concept. I teach SAT prep for high school kids, and I tell them, remember, arrogance constipates the mind, but humility is a laxative, okay? And of course, you know, they like that. There is nothing that will stymie your growth as a student as much as arrogance. Yeah, I've heard that before. I heard that back, you know, fourth grade. Yeah, that whole problem. Yeah, I got it. Yeah, I nailed it. I understand. Yeah, I know how to write an essay. Nah, you can't teach me anything. Yeah, I've already read that. I talk to adults all the time. Mention a book, like, yeah, I've read that back in high school. Okay, yeah, done with that. Yeah, has no benefit for me today. I never pick it back up. Yeah. It's a book, you know, it's a doorstop right now. Schedule and review every single day. And I would have to, especially when I taught grammar school, I would have to have a reminder up on my music stand all the time. Review this, review this, review after lunch, because I would forget. I have a propensity to get on bunny trails and to get off topic, and I would have to have constant reminders, you know, non-electronic teleprompters prompting me all the time. Okay, stay on track. Whoa, you need a rudder, buddy. Start every subject with a review of previously covered topics. And if you do this consistently, you should not need to have a review day before an exam. Okay? I think a review day is an excuse for teachers that have not been reviewing throughout the week or the month, and they're like, oh, wow, I haven't covered that in a while. Ooh, or I forgot to cover that concept or that person. Let me just put it on the review sheet, you know, and it'll kind of come up and the student will ask about it and I'll say, oh yeah, you don't remember covering that, okay. Don't try to cram anything in right before a test. And like I said, you shouldn't need to review because review is happening all the time in the context of the classroom and in your teaching. All right. And like I said at the beginning of our presentation today, if you've not read the book, The Seven Laws of Learning, I would. It's a short reading, you know, a little over 100 pages, and it's well worth the time invested.